So the title of this talk is Mass Accretion and the Magnetic Fields of Neutron Stars, the way that the magnetic field of a neutron star evolves under the influence of accretion. And the work that I'm going to describe has been done in collaboration with Still Finning at Caltech. I beg your pardon?
Sorry,
no. No. Now, the talk will be divided into... Hang, behave yourself. The talk will be divided into four parts. Yes, it's being recorded. In the first part, I'll present for you three pieces of observational evidence that point towards the fact that the magnetic field of a neutron star, in general, decreases monotonically as a function of the amount of mass accreted. And there are several explanations for this in the literature, which I won't have time to go into in detail, although I will mention them. Instead, I'll concentrate on the mechanism that Stoll and I have been looking at, namely hydromagnetic spreading and magnetic burial due to polar cap accretion. So I'll tell you what that is and also how we try to calculate it. And finally, I'll show you that there exist like 3, 4, 5 different observational tests of the mechanism of magnetic burial, which exist and which will soon be put to the test, including, say, X-ray timing experiments and gravitational wave experiments. Now, I want the puzzle that motivated our study of this subject was the question of why all, and I put that, of course, in inverted commas, millisecond pulsars have magnetic fields of order a few times 10 to the 8 Gauss. So I want you to keep that in mind as we go through, because it's going to pop up all the way through. Okay, so the first piece of observational evidence for accretion-induced field reduction comes from the ordinary pulsars. And here's the very familiar PP dot diagram for these guys, magnetic field on that axis, assuming magnetic dipole spin down, period on this axis. And as we all know, these pulsars divide into distinct classes on this plane. So there are the young ones and supernova remnants up there, main population with kind of moderate magnetic fields here, some stragglers, which are like neutron star binaries, neutron star carbon oxygen white dwarf binaries that sit in here, with intermediate magnetic fields, and those I will talk about quite a bit later. And then finally, the old ones, the millisecond pulsars in the bottom corner, which have small magnetic fields. Now, on this diagram, objects with circles around them are binary pulsars. And it turns out that roughly 3% or so of the total population is in binaries. But if I do the simple little experiment of just covering up the top and only looking at the low field pulsars, so just arbitrarily I'll cut it off at 10 to the 10 Gauss, then 70% of the low field pulsars are in binaries, roughly. And that then indicates a connection between low magnetic field and binarity, which is also a connection between low magnetic field and a history of mass transfer. Now again, just to remind you, the favored scenario, or a scenario, for how these low-field pulsars are produced, they're born up here, they spin down, go across the diagram due to magnetic dipole radiation, they cross some death line, so they turn off when they're beyond the death line, and then accretion begins and some mysterious process reduces the magnetic field, a very non-mysterious process, namely addition of angular momentum decreases the period. And then they come through here, they cross the death line, they re-illuminate, and you see them as millisecond pulsars, or low-field pulsars. And that scenario recently graduated into a fact with the discovery of this 2.5 millisecond, or sort of fact, with the discovery of this 2.5 millisecond X-ray pulsar in an LMXB. That is, of course, the missing link, the system that is just here.
Okay. Remind us also what the currently favored scenario is for potentially isolated?
Well, I don't actually know. My understanding is that some people think they were binary and then they got eaten away. Okay, and here, just since it's so beautiful, let me show you the dynamical power spectrum for that 2.5 millisecond X-ray pulsar. There it is at 400 hertz. This is frequency versus time. And superimposed on top of it, you see the modulation due to the 2-hour orbital period. Second piece of observational evidence for accretion-induced magnetic field reduction comes from neutron stars in binary systems with high mass companions. Those companions may be OB supergiants, BE stars, some neutron, and like another neutron star, so double neutron star binaries, carbon oxygen, white dwarf, etc. I've also added, for some unknown reason here, these low mass systems, so ignore them for the moment. Okay, now this diagram shows these systems plotted on the magnetic field versus accreted mass plane. The magnetic field is determined by saying that they lie on the spin-up line for magnetized equilibrium rotators, and that of course just means that you assume that the neutron star rotation frequency and the rotation frequency of the co-rotating magnetosphere is equal to the Kepler frequency at the edge of the magnetosphere, and then it's in equilibrium, because if you tried to add some more material, it would just get flung away centrifugally. Okay, so that's how they get this in this diagram. This guy comes from just the age and multiplying by some accretion rate that you would expect from evolutionary considerations. Chan and van den Heuvel in 1986 used this kind of data to show that the magnetic field decreases with age, and therefore with accreted mass, because the older it is, the more mass it accreted in the simple thing. And the appropriate timescale for that was of order 5 million years. That is not great data, but there is better stuff later, which I'll show. Okay, the third piece of observational evidence comes from neutron stars in binaries with low mass companions, namely helium white dwarfs, which are in an extremely circular orbit. Now, van den Heuvel and Bitsraki in 1995 showed that for these systems, there is a correlation between magnetic field and orbital period. Namely, that as the magnetic field decreases, the orbital period also decreases. And that then means that the accreted mass increases. Okay? And that just reflects the dichotomy between the tight binaries down here, which are disk-fed, so that you dump a lot of material onto the neutron star, and the wide binaries out here, which are wind-fed, and they only get a little bit of material onto the neutron star.
What about the two exceptions?
We'll come to those in just a moment, yes. They're quite annoying, in fact. Okay. And this is also, I should say, rather poor data and has problems with it, but there's more modern data, which I'll show later in the talk. This was just for historical cuteness. Okay, now, this accreted mass, well, the accreted mass that just disappeared up here, comes again from some evolutionary calculations using the observed orbital period, and those are done under several assumptions. It turns out, as I'll discuss later, that these accreted masses are now being questioned, and the main assumption that is being questioned as part of that is the assumption of zero mass loss during accretion. It turns out that the accretion is probably pretty non-conservative, and so these estimated masses are not quite right. Now I come to the exceptions. The top one here is a globular cluster pulsar. So that one we're just going to toss out, because even though it's an exception, it's obviously complicated. We'll never be able to understand it because it's in a globular cluster, and globular cluster evolution is complicated. But this one, we can't really toss out because it is a normal pulsar within this context. And it's a thorn in the side for all attempts to explain this magnetic field reduction, because it just lies way off the plot. And I will come back later to tell you that it has been cited as an example of tuned accretion-induced collapse. I'll explain what that is later on.
There's also an accreting pulsar in there. This bursar that was found about 5 years ago.
Okay.
Which is 11-day orbit. It's the cheapest guy. 1744 minus 3.
Oh, yes. And what is its magnetic field?
11,000 in 10 days. It's just next to it.
Ah.
Okay. One thing I could mention that that's greatly idea that if you look at 17, 18 minus 19, it's actually very far out of the core of the globular cluster and may well be on its way out. So one other way of cheating yourself out of this is just saying that 1831 minus 00 is also formed in a globular cluster, but unfortunately left the globular cluster.
Ah, okay. Is it near any globular cluster?
But it doesn't have to be, that's the problem. Yeah. And 17, 18, minus 19 is really far out of it. It's really most likely that it's on its way out rather than still bound to it.
Interesting.
What is the ordinate scale roughly for MA over mass of the sun? How much accreted mass for the 10th
of the top line? 0.04,
0.6.
Excuse me, Andrew.
Mm-hmm.
We can say that the high accretion gives a low magnetic field. We cannot say just the opposite. The high magnetic field just makes a lower efficient accretion. So why don't we can say what is the cause or what is the effect?
Well, these accreted masses are always calculated and based on an evolutionary calculation, which says that the companion star is going to give up, you know, X amount of material. And then there's a question of how much of that actually falls onto the neutron star, and that may or may not be affected by the magnetic field, but these masses are all how much the companion star wants to give, so that's kind of independent of the field of the neutron star.
The
is that in tight binaries, which are short orbital periods, you have disk-fed systems, and so lots of mass gets dumped onto the neutron star, whereas in wide binaries, you have wind-fed systems, less mass is dumped onto the neutron star.
It's not that the orbital
period
shortens when you accrete more mass. The
orbital period shortens when you accrete more mass. Yeah, that's correct.
The mass transfer is the contrary, you know. The orbit should expand when you accrete more mass.
Okay.
So this is basically an error. Which is really more or less like you said, but I think
you say better because
systems, but at least the mass transfer is unstable for the very long period. Well,
it seems that level is off for the disk effect.
Well, yes, but you've got these masses. See, this goes from 0.6 to 0.8. And I would say, although I'm not an expert, that there's some uncertainty regarding these masses. So it may be a more gradual, like it may not level off like this. It's just that it looks like it did because of this weird determination of the masses. Second, please.
There's another piece of physics which makes the field get stuck at 8 times 10 3 times 10 to the equals.
There is another piece of physics, yes.
And then it will
be. Right, or it could be that, absolutely. Absolutely. So we're disentangling those two possibilities. There's obviously going to be a bit of a nuisance. Okay, so now why does this field reduction happen? And here is where I just have to skip everything else that other people have done because I don't have time. But let me just mention the kind of general pictures. I mean, there are plenty of people in the audience who have worked on this, but one possibility is interactions between superfluid vortices and superconductor fluxoids in the interior of the neutron star, and as it spins down and spins up, these things get pushed around and you change the magnetic topology and you change the magnetic dipole, etc., etc. Plate tectonics. That's one possibility. Another model that is another mechanism that's been suggested, the field is screened by diamagnetic blobs of material that just get that fall onto the star, that have little currents that screen the field. Yet another thing, inverse thermoelectric battery, won't have time to discuss it, etc. The mechanism that I want to concentrate on in this talk is actually a very naive one, and that is that the magnetic field should be buried in some sense under the hydrodynamic inflow that comes from the accretion disk. Now, it's not clear exactly what burial means. Is it buried spherically? There are details, very big details, and those are the details that I'm going to discuss. But the general picture will be one where you just squash the magnetic field under an accretion inflow. And the question is, how do you calculate, and, well, how does that happen, and how do you calculate how it happens? Now, before I talk about that, there's a very important element in any burial mechanism, and that is the question of accelerated ohmic decay. We know that the crust of a neutron star is a good conductor, but it's not a perfect conductor. The electrons scatter off impurities and phonons in the crystal lattice. And since it's imperfect, there is a resistivity, and therefore the currents that generate the magnetic field of the star, to the extent that they are in the crust, are going to degrade over time due to ohmic losses. The time for that degradation is given here. Sigma is the conductivity, L is the square, L is the characteristic length scale of the field. Now, for an isolated neutron star, this is a very long time which we don't care about. It's 10 to the 11 years, way too long to be interesting.
Isn't that only phonon is contributing?
I beg your pardon?
Isn't that the number you get if the only reason for having decay is phonon scattering?
This very long time? Well, it depends very sensitively on the concentration of impurities.
Right.
So if you have a large concentration of impurities, then yes,
but
you can get...
go down by 5 orders of magnitude.
Absolutely, I agree.
That's a small...
Mm-hmm. Sure. I don't want to belabor that point here because it's not... But yes, you're right.
It passes well as a current also in the crust.
Yeah, and whether the... As I said, if the currents are in the core, then...
The very high density can be given.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now, if you have accretion, though, so as was pointed out, this is just a crude number, but ignoring the complications. If you have accretion, then two competing processes come into play. The first is that by accretion you heat the crust, that increases the resistance, and therefore the ohmic decay goes faster. But at the same time, as you accrete material, you push just hydrodynamically the former crust to deeper and deeper layers, and eventually you push it into the superconducting core where there is no ohmic decay, and so the ohmic decay freezes out. And so this process tends to slow down the decay while this one speeds it up. How those two balance out compared to each other depends on complicated things I'm not going to go into here.
You say burial of magnetic fields, that if that happens, why doesn't it happen then in the high mass, the X-ray pulsar, so to speak?
It does. I think it does. You only in the high mass X-ray pulsars, let's say if you were accreting 10 to the minus 4 solar masses, then 10 to the 12, 10 to the 11 gas is fine, as you will see, I mean, under the burial mechanism. Okay? I answering your question slightly badly because, let me go on and you'll see why. The things that I'm going to talk about do not actually include this very important question of ohmic decay. Okay, if you are not including ohmic decay and you just look at how the field is buried sort of hydrodynamically and geometrically, then it turns out that for those guys, if you're only accreting a small amount of mass, like 10 to the minus 4 solar masses, you get the 10 to the 12, 10 to the 11 gas without any problem. And then the other ones are way reduced. But I can't answer as to how the ohmic decay is going to affect those because we haven't done the calculation. Okay, so just to illustrate that, here is the results from papers by Romani in 1990 and Kona Bhattacharya in 1997. You can see here magnetic field plotted as a function of spin period. In this case, the solid line corresponds to a pulsar which has no accretion. So early in its life, some dynamo or something cranks up the field to 10 to 12, and then it basically stays constant over time without any change. If accretion happens, then there are two possible paths. If the accretion rate is high, the neutron star follows the red path. Magnetic field freezes out at about 10 to the 10 gas. If it is low, then the magnetic field follows the green path, freezes out at about 10 to the 8 gas. Similar thing is shown in the lower diagram. This time, magnetic field, though, against accreted mass. And you can see, firstly, the overall monotonic decrease of the field with the accreted mass. And secondly, the value of the field at which you freeze out increases with m dot. That's kind of counterintuitive, but as it's saying high M dot, you get a higher final field. But the reason for that is that a high M dot pushes the crust down into the superconducting core quicker, and so the field decay freezes out sooner. Now, these calculations are basically, and this is kind of a crude description, but to zero forward are done in this way. You have Faraday's law, you have Ampere's law, where the current density is proportional to the electric field in the rest frame of the fluid. And then you combine them, and you find that the time rate of change of the magnetic field has an advective part, which just says that if you have a parcel of fluid with field in it, you move it, it moves, the field moves as well. And a diffusive part, if you have a parcel of field with field through it, then over time the field lines diffuse outwards because of ohmic decay. Those correspond to the pushing into the core and the ohmic decay that I mentioned before. The problem, you know, there are two problems with this description though. The first is that there's only one equation here, namely this one, but there are two unknowns, B and V. In the papers I described before, that's avoided by simply setting V to be something. Romani sets it to be zero, and the others set it to be correspond to a spherical inflow or burial. But we Konar, sure, Konar and Bhattacharya. There's a sequence of papers, Urpin, Konenkov, a whole... Yes. The problem with this is that as you move the magnetic field around and distort it, the magnetic field itself will exert tension and pressure forces on the fluid, okay? And those will change the density distribution in the surface layers and mess up this velocity field so that you can't just prescribe it like this. It's not a self-consistent solution. The second problem is, again, specific to the papers I mentioned before, that the magnetic field is assumed in those cases to be derived from a vector potential which has a dipolar dependence on latitude. Okay? And that, by definition, suppresses the generation, well, in fact, it forbids the generation of high-order multipoles. The work that I've been doing with Stirl, and which I'm now going to describe, gets around both of these problems that we try, at least, to solve for the magnetic field and the density self-consistently. We allow for arbitrary multipoles, whatever happens, happens. And we introduce a third, turns out, critical aspect to the problem, namely that the accretion is not spherical, but rather it is channeled magnetically onto the magnetic polar caps. Okay, and it turns out that to treat this properly, you need to have both those other things that I mentioned before. You need to be able to solve for the B and the rho self-consistently, and you need to allow for higher order multipoles. Now, let me just say that this is, we're not the first to think about aspherical accretion, and among other people, one example is the paper by Brown and Bilston in 1998, where they discussed the development of a polar magnetic mountain.
So, Andrew, you're going to get a region where in the center of the cap, you're going to have the pushing it into the superconductor, and in the rims, you're going to have the heating. And that's which wins out, is the question. Is that sort of a...
Possibly. As I said to Henk, we don't actually consider the heating and the ohmic decay, and we should, but we don't, just because it's difficult. So that's a separate question. Okay, so accretion onto the polar cap, how does this work? Well, here's my cartoon, which I think is unnecessary, but I'll put it up anyway, of what the magnetosphere looks like at the beginning of polar cap accretion, when the magnetic field of the star is still strong, so 10 to the 12 Gauss or whatever, not much material has accreted. Now, the inner disk boundary stands off at some distance, which is set by the balance between magnetic tension and the ram pressure in the disk. And there are two types of field lines, the closed ones, closed, and the open ones, which connect somewhere out here in the disk. Now, if the accreting material is a good conductor, which it is, you are not going to get material flowing across field lines. We have ideal MHD regime, and so material flows along field lines. That means it can't penetrate into this closed region here and instead is forced to go and fall on the pole and make a little mountain.
Just a deep
detail, but that's not quite true because there are instabilities.
I agree totally. So right here, for example, there's Raleigh Taylor and Kelvin Helmholtz.
You can have a very efficient flow across field lines because of this instability, mm-hmm. even in ideal MHD.
I agree.
It tells you that the length scales on which this happened will adjust to whatever your connectivity is.
Mm-hmm. I agree totally.
Solar prominences.
I agree totally. That is completely not included in the calculation we have done, and it should be. But again, it's difficult, as you know.
This doesn't change the general picture.
At this point, not yet.
No. He's waiting to pounce.
Okay, now let me tell you about the Polakat Mountain. This mountain is supported in the lateral direction by the tension in these magnetic field lines. Okay, so the pressure at the base of the mountain is balanced by the magnetic tension in these lines. It's a bit like a swimming pool. The mountain is the water, and then the field lines are the sides of the pool. When you add enough material, the pressure at the bottom of the mountain exceeds the restoring force from the magnetic tension. So the swimming pool can't hold in the water anymore, and the result is that these field lines are distorted, like towards the equator. And because this is MHD, the fluid is also spreading sideways towards the equator as the field lines distort.
Before that happens, why doesn't the mountain sink in along the field lines?
It does.
The rest of the star expands.
It does to some extent. But remember, as I was just about to point out, the amount of mass that you need to mess up that field is 10 to the minus 12 solar masses. Okay? So some sinking, absolutely, but it's a very small amount of mass. There will be sinking and there will be spreading, a combination of the two.
Well, the other way to say it is that for the X-ray pulsars, at least, one does have to worry about relative buoyancy.
The composition.
Okay, now here's the calculation by Brown and Bilson of the hydromagnetic structure of that mountain. Z is up. X is along the pole, and forget about these two. Here you have contours of constant density, the red dashed things, so there's the mountain, and the black curves are, and the solid curves are contours of magnetic field. Now, this might look like a very small distortion to your eye, but that's deceptive. The scales here are different. This is 0 to 1500 centimeters. This is 0 to 10 to the 5 centimeters. So if we were to blow this out to its real size in this direction, then you would get significant distortion. In fact, distortion of order 45 degrees, like this. Now, at that point, Lars and Ed stopped their calculation because, among other things, there's numerical problems. With the solution, you start to get loops and they drift off and it's a bit unphysical and stuff. But remember that you get to this point after adding just 10 to the minus 12 solar masses. So in the context of Hovsepian, in the context of a standard accreting source where you have 10 to the minus 2 solar masses or so, this is very, very early state. Yes?
So this 10 to the minus 12 doesn't depend on magnetic field?
It is, no, it depends, in fact, linearly on the magnetic field.
So
the square. 10 to the 12, starting with 10 to the 12. Yeah. The square, actually, not really.
At this point, I just want to mention that this is a field configuration in which you're partially sort of confining a certain amount of mass by mm-hmm. the lines wrapping around like this.
Highly unstable. I'm going to say this again and again. This is a very kind of toy, crude, incomplete, blah, blah, blah description. All of the things that Henk is saying point to that.
So if it's so wildly unstable, why didn't Brown and Bilson, how was this calculation done? I guess as far?
It was an equilibrium calculation.
It's a series of equilibrium.
You do find equilibrium to a certain point.
Right. No, I understand.
And so it wasn't even a stable equilibrium, but beyond a certain point.
It wasn't a time revolution.
No time revolution. Right.
So now,
mm-hmm. Now, the one thing I would say is, you know, it is totally simplified and idealized. Having said that, the fact that there's such a huge difference, you just add 10 to the minus 12 and you start to screw it up, means that, at least in some sense, you know, the field may spring back for example, but immediately you've added another 10 to the minus 12 and you push it to the side again. So it is highly unstable, but at the same time you always have this huge discrepancy between the hydrostatic pressures and the magnetic pressures. And so
what does it take to accrete 10 to the minus
12? 10 to the minus 12 I think is 10 to the minus 4 of a year, so like a day.
That's right. Now compare it with the Alphane time.
It's short, it's longer.
Right, it's longer. So, and these instabilities go.
Alphane time, yeah. Mm-hmm. I agree. Now the instabilities, you also have to do the like nonlinear saturation of the instability, right? So you want to know what the final state, you don't just want to know that it's unstable because it's going to go to, and then the question is, when you put more material onto the messed up state, what's going to happen? Yeah. Yeah. Who knows? Okay.
What magnetic field strength you get when you compress?
I'll come to that in just a moment. It's a good question. Okay, so let me quickly say that, okay, you bend the field lines towards the equator, but since you're conserving magnetic flux, everything is happening relatively slowly. The field strength in this compressed field region goes up, and so now you establish a new hydromagnetic equilibrium between the pressure at the base of this column and the heightened magnetic tension in these field lines. Okay, so the more material you add, you pass through a sequence, as we said before, of hydromagnetic equilibria, where this equilibrium point is shifting closer and closer to the equator. And then, of course, you get this very flaring configuration, which goes to a dipole in the far field, and this is what imagined to be a magnetic tutu. I take no responsibility for this word whatsoever.
So, accretion proceed in this configuration?
Well, accretion in this configuration may proceed by coming down here and then falling onto these parts of the star. The one thing that, you know, that one hopes it doesn't do is come in across here. And then, of course, there's the whole instability issue, which may mean that it doesn't, in fact, come along there. But in this simple picture, it'll just come down here and fall over here and spread down.
And how much time does it take to build this configuration?
Well, this configuration is like, remember, this. There's a whole sequence of these configurations, sequence of equilibria. The time to establish any one equilibrium is just the Alphane crossing time over the appropriate length scales, which is short. It's like, say, 100 seconds or a few seconds. Did you say much less? Well, it depends what the density is, right?
Scale height there?
10 meters?
Well, milliseconds, I would say.
Well, it depends on the density. I did actually calculate it can be milliseconds down in the depth of the crust. But the time then to go through the sequence is just the characteristic time for the accretion. Okay. So now to answer Danny's...
It's on a long time scales. Mm-hmm. It would be frozen, the magnetic field. The magnetic field decay in those parts of...
It will decay in these parts. And we just estimated that it would decay, but we haven't done the calculation with the decay. But down here, sure, because as you'll see in a sec, this thing is like 10 meters or a meter, and it, on those length scales there is decay. Sure.
So if you just start with accretion in this configuration, how long would you have to wait for the new material to basically subduct, to fall back to the hemisphere of the star, and as presumably for the field to be
It depends. I think basically what you're asking is the balance between like the flow time and the, well,
well, is, first of all, is it correct that if you just stop the accretion, that,
yes,
that material would then fall?
I think so. Yeah, I think it would.
Probably
it should. Well,
so what?
It can't. It's kind of complicated, right? Because once you get into this state, you can't really have it fall in this direction. That's going to cost a lot of effort because you're going to be pushing, like squashing an already very strong field even more. I guess it can sort of fall like this, but you know, to what extent it does and what the balance is. And when it falls like that, then this will relax a little bit. But how it works itself out, I mean, I really don't know, because that's something we definitely haven't looked at.
Okay.
The more I look at this vision, I want to say that it should be strongly relate Taylor stable.
Sure. Vicious.
So what you may imagine is that, you know, the matter would make a hole in the magnetic field lattice. It will push them around and would flow where it was, where on average magnetic fields would remain, you know, now confined to a separate domains, but would remain more or less in place.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And maybe. I can't tell you because we haven't done that calculation. I will show you something later on which suggests that it may not be as simple as you describe, because the condition for Rayleigh-Taylor instability is actually possibly, there are two aspects to it. One is it may actually be quite difficult to satisfy, and I'll show you why. The second thing is that even if it's satisfied initially, it goes unstable, but then the configuration relaxes, and all of a sudden Rayleigh-Taylor shuts off. When I get to the end, I'll try and tell you why. But I agree with you. This should be very unstable. I say again, everything I'm talking about, you have to bear in mind that it may not be happening because of all of the instability. But just bear with me. Okay. So now, to answer Danny's question, we estimate in that very toy model what the 2-2 is going to look like. So here is the model. Zero magnetic field here, and that's where all the material fell. Lots of magnetic field here with not much material. The two conditions that govern the evolution are conservation of magnetic flux and hydromagnetic force balance. From this one, you can see that the magnetic field in the 2-2 goes as the accreted mass to the half power. That then gives us, remembering that for 10 to the minus 12 solar masses, you didn't distort the field very, you started to distort the field. If you say add 10 to the minus 2 solar masses, that's a factor of 10 to the 10, which then gives you a factor of 10 to the 5. This should be 10 to the 17 Gauss. Then the 2-2 is very small, a fraction of 10 to the minus 5 of the stellar radius. Now, again, these are extreme. Even if it wasn't unstable, these are ridiculous numbers, especially the 10 to the 17. When you do the calculation properly, as I'll describe in a sec, you get more reasonable things like 10 to the 15 and 10 to the minus 3. But still, it's a bizarre configuration, almost certainly unstable. Still, let's just press on. Now, the thing that I'm going to do, and when I say, by the way, press on, it's not that we're ignoring the instabilities, because they're not. They're almost certainly there, but you can't... You can't just say that something is unstable. You need to calculate it, and we aren't able to calculate it yet. We will. Okay, now, the first thing we want to calculate, given this setup, is the magnetic dipole moment. So here is the first happy thing I have to show you. Magnetic dipole moment is an angular integral of the radial component of the magnetic field. The angle integral has small part, because the 2-2 is very thin in this direction. The 2-2 field is very strong when you do this. You end up with a dipole moment of 10 to the 8 Gauss. So even though, the message here is, even though you squashed the field so that locally it's very intense, the overall dipole moment is way down because you pushed it all into a thin band in the equator. The second thing that we can calculate is the mass quadrupole moment. You can see that the mass is not distributed evenly because the field is distorted and pushes some of it out. When you do that, you find that the ratio, the fractional difference of the principal moments of inertia is of order 10 to the minus 7 for this amount of accreted mass. Again, keep that number in mind. I'll come back to it in a second.
So, Andrew, what happens to the contributions to the dipole moment from larger radii outside your 2-2?
The contributions to the dipole moment from larger radii outside the 2-2. This integral is done outside the star. So outside the surface, just outside the surface of the star. So you're now in a point where you're in vacuum in this simple model. And then the multipoles will be preserved, you know, henceforth, because it's a curl-free field. So whatever multipoles you have at that boundary will also be the multipoles at infinity. Good question. Okay, now.
Well, I have something wrong in the number. You had a 10 to the 18th Gauss field.
10 to the 17, let's say. I wrote 10 to the 18.
Well, that makes it a little better.
Actually, it doesn't make it much
but
better.
You have a layer, which I gather is something like 10 to the 14 grams per centimeter square. I'm just trying to see.
Yeah, yeah.
It seemed to me that you could hold that much with that layer. I think 10 to the minus 12 solar mass is over 10 to the 13 centimeter square area.
You can. We should discuss it later. Right? You can.
Two solar masses.
I'm sorry.
Symbolize two solar masses.
10 minus 12.
Over 4 pi r squared. Not for the end.
Oh, then you can.
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
I thought this initial spreading was.
Initially 10 to the minus 12, but then by the time you get to the numbers I showed you, you're at 10 to the minus 2.
So these are 10 to the 10 square centimeters.
Yes. So that's the final. Yes, I'm sorry. Right, right.
10 to the
7. Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So that's, sorry, I didn't explain. That's the final stage. Okay, so here's what we actually did. Again, because the Alfvén time is short compared to the relevant flow times, you can look at you can calculate a quasi-static sequence of hydromagnetic equilibria. We assume ideal MHD, so no ohmic dissipation. Very bad, because it's obvious that there is ohmic dissipation. And in fact, after you get the answers, you can work back and ask, was there ohmic dissipation? And sure enough, on the shorter scales, there was. But again, we wanted to see the overall geometry, and so we leave that out. Equilibria, so instabilities are simply ignored. Polytrope, and we also assume axisymmetry so that you have the magnetic field as the gradient of a scalar flux function. And then the calculation that we do is just take the force balance equation, which is pressure, gravity, and the Lorentz forces, project it along the magnetic field. That gives you basically the equation for a polytropic star, but with this magnetic correction. And then perpendicular to the magnetic field, that gives you something which says that the curl of the field is equal to some current which depends on the density of material locally and also on the flux function. And then the program is just to solve these two simultaneously for rho and for psi. Okay? And that'll give us the density and the magnetic field.
And which polytropic index did you take?
We took a single polytropic index for the whole star, which is obviously also not a good approximation, and we took 4/3, so 3, n equals 3. Yep, so we draw no distinction between the relativistic and the non-relativistic parts. It's
but
all relativistic.
In the very surface layer, so the polytropic index will depend on the magnetic field.
I
agree. Because of the quantization.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And maybe at those very strong fields, it depends quite a bit. Okay. Now there's some, I'm running out of time, so there's some details of the calculation which I'll leave out, and you can ask me about them later if you're interested. Let me now move on to the last part of the talk, which is the predictions, the observable predictions that this magnetic burial idea makes. The first of these observable predictions is the scaling of magnetic dipole moment versus accreted mass. Now, we can obviously, from the theory that I just described, calculate the magnetic dipole moment as a function of that accreted mass. We need an estimate of the polar cap size, just get that from Gershon-Lamb type arguments. And the result is that magnetic dipole moment scales inversely with accreted mass to the 1.3 power, and that's expected. The more mass you add, the lower the dipole moment. It also depends on the initial magnetic field in this way. Now, how does that compare with the data? Well, here is now the more modern version of the data that I showed you before. And it's a complicated diagram, so let me do it slowly. What you're looking at here is, again, magnetic field versus accreted mass. The points are data, the curves are theory. Now, the points, there are four different types of objects plotted on this graph. The open triangles are neutron star, helium, white dwarf, binary. Now, the accreted mass for those guys is, again, calculated from evolutionary modeling. And there is a question as to how much this accreted mass is the accreted mass that you would get if 100% landed on the neutron star. Mass transfer was completely conservative. As I mentioned before, there is recent work, including work by Torres, that suggests that only a small fraction, like maybe 5% of that mass, actually ends up on the neutron star. And in that case, these guys should be moved over to the left. black, well, it's solid triangles, are neutron star, neutron star, and neutron star, carbon, oxygen, white dwarf binaries. Their accreted masses are determined in a similar way. The solid squares are LMXBs. Their magnetic field is determined from some beat frequency model for the QPOs seen in this system. So there's uncertainty there. And including...
Should be across the whole...
Yes, that's right. including I agree 100%. And the open squares are high-mass X-ray binaries where you get the magnetic field by assuming that they lie on the spin-up line for magnetized equilibrium rotators.
Why don't you just use the measured magnetic fields for high-mass X-ray
binaries? Because when I made this plot, I wasn't aware they existed, but Deepto told me about them, yes. Now, the theory, the central solid curve, corresponds to that burial thing I showed you before for an initial magnetic field of 3 by 10 to the 12 Gauss and an accretion rate of 2 by 10 to the minus 8 solar masses per year. Dotted lines on either side are accretion rates 10 times higher and lower. Dashed lines on either side are magnetic fields 3 times higher and lower. So 10 to the 13 here, 10 to initial magnetic field, 10 to the 13, 10 to the 12. Okay, now, both, obviously, the theory and the data show a general decrease in magnetic field with accreted mass, and they are in, like, moderately in accord for whatever that's worth. Okay, now, there are three obvious outliers here, and all three of them are bizarre for other reasons, so maybe it's not a problem that they're outliers, but maybe it is. These two are the only two neutron star helium white dwarf systems which have large eccentricities, greater than 0.01, and large orbital periods, like greater than 1,000 days. So if you make a list of these systems, these two stand out for that reason, which is obviously independent to all this business of field burial. Second, the third outlier, this guy, is the thorn in the side, which I mentioned before, 1831 minus 00. It has a low mass, maybe even substellar companion, and has been cited by some people as a candidate for tuned accretion-induced collapse, which just means that the accretion is happening onto a white dwarf. The white dwarf collapses into a neutron star when Chandrasekhar limit is exceeded, and almost exactly at that point, the accretion shuts off, purely by luck. And then that means that you've way overestimated the accreted mass, and this one should be somewhere back here. Okay. Now, second prediction. As I mentioned before, when you distort the magnetic field on the star, you are also distorting the mass distribution in the surface layer. And that produces a mass quadrupole, which in general is going to be misaligned with the rotation axis. If anything, it's going to be aligned with the magnetic axis, probably not even that. And that then produces gravitational radiation. The question is, how strong is that gravitational radiation? Can we see it? Well, again, we can calculate the epsilon, the ellipticity of the star, because we know we've solved, supposedly, for the density distribution. And so we do that. We can get that as a function of the accreted mass, and we can also get, as I just showed you, the magnetic dipole as a moment as a function of accreted mass. So that allows us to eliminate the accreted mass and obtain an expression for the gravitational wave strain, which is in terms of the ellipticity, an expression for the gravitational wave strain in terms of the magnetic dipole moment, which in principle could be observed. And that correlation is shown here. We have that the gravitational wave strain scales inversely to the 1.4 power with magnetic dipole moment, which makes sense within this model because what you're saying is the more material you accrete, the higher the lower the dipole moment, and therefore the higher the gravitational wave strain because you've distorted the star more. Notice that these two things here, the distance to the object and the initial field, are unknown. And so that's sad because it means that this correlation will not be clean, but it should still be there. Now the question is, can you see the gravitational waves? And what we have done is take standard kind of numbers here, and then say, okay, if you've added enough material to get to a magnetic field of 10 to the 8 Gauss dipole moment, your electricity will be this, and your gravitational wave strain will be 10 to the minus 25. Add enough material to get to 10 to the 9 Gauss, you have a smaller electricity, and therefore a smaller gravitational wave strain. Fortunately, with these systems, we can hope to integrate coherently for a long time because we know, hopefully, from X-ray timing or whatever, their period. Okay? And if we sit there and integrate for a year at the known period, then you have an enhancement factor, a root n enhancement factor of order 10 to the 5, which you should then multiply these numbers by to get 10 to the minus 20, 5 by 10 to the minus 22, etc. And that is then to be compared with roughly an RMS sensitivity for initial LIGO of 10 to the minus 21 at this frequency. Okay? So, impossibly observable. Now, again, I have to say what we've been saying all along, that these numbers are the result of a relatively crude calculation of a very crude model. So, you know, they could easily be off by a factor of 10, and if it's in the wrong direction, you don't see it at all. That's the negative aspect of it. The positive aspect is that if this is present, then obviously it constitutes a very nice source for LIGO because it's always there. It's not transient. You don't have to wait for it. It's predictable. It's always there. You know the period, so you can integrate coherently, and the period doesn't change, so you don't need to worry about sophisticated templates, etc. No, and I will come to that. It may not stay around after the accretion has stopped. Now that and that problem, and it is a problem, is kind of a problem for all potential models for the distortion. That you know they may go away after it stops, and then you're left without. Okay, now the third observational prediction concerns the torque on X-ray millisecond pulsars. Now, let me see how to say this. Okay. The accretion is expected to occur in two stages. The first stage, magnetic dipole torques are not important, gravitational waves are not important, nothing is important. All you have is angular momentum spinning up, accretion adding angular momentum to the star. Now, in this case, you have obviously a relation between the period of the rotation period of the star and the amount of mass that's been added. But we've already calculated the magnetic field, the magnetic dipole moment, as a function of mass being added. So we can eliminate the amount of mass added to get a relation between the spin period and the magnetic dipole moment. That is shown here. However, when you spin it up to, say, period of 5 milliseconds or less, angular momentum lost to gravity waves becomes substantial. This is Lars's discovery from 1998. And when it becomes substantial, the accretion torque is roughly balanced by the gravitational radiation spin-down torque. And that, again, as Lars said, tells us that millisecond pulsars of this X-ray millisecond pulsars will hang up at an equilibrium period, which is a function of the distortion of the star and also other things like the M dot and the rotation, other things like the M dot. Now, the extra wrinkle that this kind of magnetic burial idea adds to this picture is that although the neutron star hangs up at this equilibrium spin period, the epsilon, the distortion, is still changing, okay, because you're still accreting material, so you're still distorting the magnetic field. And you're making the star then itself, the star, more and more distorted. And that means that even though, like, at every moment, once you get to this stage, at every instant, you're in equilibrium between these two torques, on the longer time scale, as you accrete material, this is constantly increasing, because again, you're distorting more and more. And so the gravitational radiation losses become more and more effective. And so as time goes by, your equilibrium period moves up to longer periods. Okay? Even though at every instant it's in equilibrium, the equilibrium period is steadily increasing. And that is expressed here as a function of magnetic dipole moment. So the prediction then here is that if you looked at one of, if you could find one of these X-ray pulsars, then millisecond X-ray pulsars, and measure the torque, we would expect a P dot that is positive. So spin period is increasing with time. And if you could, by some fluke, also measure the magnetic dipole moments, then you could look to see whether these kinds of scalings are confirmed.
Andrew, the problem with that prediction is that for a given observation, of course, n dot's changing.
Mm-hmm.
The difficulty is really knowing, that's a change, that p dot is on a secular time scale, but there's the fact that this equilibrium is not necessarily satisfied at every instant in time.
I agree with
so
you.
So that's a difficult, unfortunately,
I agree with you, and further to that, it's particularly annoying because the overall equilibrium is changing on, let's say, the accretion timescale, and that would, of course, be also exactly the timescale on which the m dot would change. So it's tied together.
And yes. your piston would be spun down by gravitational radiation. So all of your initial estimates of magnetic field would be wrong.
Say that again, please.
Well, if you still have this configuration after ignition stop, you still have your
sure.
Quadrupole.
But you won't, probably. I have a slide on that. This is an X-ray millisecond pulsar. This is while accretion is going on. This is not a radio millisecond pulsar. This is the torque on an X-ray millisecond pulsar. So, for example, SAX, J18, blah, blah, blah. If you can measure the torque on that, which in principle you can, then that is what this slide is doing.
Extremely variable in that suspension.
No, actually, is that a transient? Yeah, it is. Sure. But yes, exactly. But the radio millisecond pulsar, that means that the accretion is stopped, and then what you're saying is correct. Okay. That is that.
So you're halfway through your view graphs, but your time is almost out.
Oh, I'm done.
Oh, okay. Just looking at the size of the
pile. No, that's I'm done. Here, Yuri, is the answer to your question. Now, you, well, maybe I...
You have 5 minutes. You have 5 minutes.
I do?
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
decide which.
I've only got two more overhead, so okay. If I have 5 minutes, it's fine. I'm reluctant to put this one up because I actually... I don't understand. I don't understand the contents of this overhead, but they've been told to me by different people at different points in time. So I guess I will put it up and ask the members in the audience responsible to explain what's going on. So this is Yuri's contribution. I now repeat it for you. There is this issue of X-ray bursts, which Lars and Andrew Cumming are working on at the moment. And one observation there is that the spin frequency, what is identified as the spin frequency anyway, drifts by a few hertz during the course of the burst. And the canonical explanation is that that's because the envelope on the surface of the burst puffs up, and so you get differential rotation, it lags. And that would then be possible if the magnetic field is strong, and this is what Lars and Andrew have been looking at, because the field would be wound up and would then prevent the differential rotation. The connection with the bizarre picture of Burial that I've been showing you is that Burial obviously predicts basically zero magnetic field over most of the star except in that equatorial band. Maybe that has something to do with something, or maybe not. Now the second issue is QPOs. There are drifts in QPO frequencies as well, and Dong, I'm not sure if he's here, mentioned to me that you can these drifts have at various times been explained in context of the famous beat frequency model, and that depends on the position of the inner edge of the accretion disk relative to the star, and that position is going to be modified from the way that position changes with accretion rate will be modified from the usual dependence, because in the context of this Burial model, the disk runs into a magnetic wall where you have all of these multipoles bunched up near the equator, and it can't penetrate any further.
I'm completely confused. When you talked all the time about the star, which is accreted 10 to the minus 2 solar mass, mm-hmm. I mean, that is almost certainly not the case for an animal speed. You have to spin it up. That in itself takes more mass.
More than 10 to the minus 2.
Any, the
sure. Any,
and also, there's no pulsations in the persistent disk emission. So, how can you have any sort of big, or even if it's not so big, spot left on the star? Wouldn't you just see that in a persistent emission?
Sure, but it's like a band of, let's say, 10 meters or a meter all the way around the equator. Is it guaranteed that you would? That's the only. Okay. Like imagine in this sort of simplified picture, everything is uniform, and then in this band there's nothing, or
but
vice
why
versa.
Why would it be exactly around the equator?
Just because the accretion is happening. I beg your pardon? Yes, magnetic. Sure. But the question is whether the small fraction of area that's covered compared to the total star area, whether you would see the modulation. I agree. I mean, you know. Okay, so let me just finish then with my final overhead some remarks. Just returning to the question of the floor magnetic field, well, why do you never get less than 10 to the 8 Gauss? For 10 to the minus 1, change this to 10 to the minus 1 solar masses, which is the limit of validity of our calculations here. Anything more than 10 to the minus 1, our method kind of breaks down. For 10 to the minus 1, you will get a field of about 10 to the 8 Gauss. It also turns out that at 10 to the 8 Gauss, the inner edge of the accretion disk hits the star, by chance. And at 10 to the 8 Gauss, the ohmic decay is really important for those short-scale features. Second issue is the issue of the ohmic decay. I'm not going to say anything about it except we didn't include it, but it's very important. The third, work is being done on that right now by Lars and Andrew. Third point is that there have been claims of a field gap in the radio pulsar population at about 10 to the 10, 10 to the 11 Gauss. And still tells me that it's not obvious there actually is a field gap. But if there were, then within the context of the Boreal model, it would be easily, really easily understandable, because the amount of time, like to go from 10 to the 12 Gauss to 10 to the 11 Gauss, all you need is 10 to the minus 5 solar masses, which is 10 to the 4 years, 10 at the canonical accretion rate. To get to 10 to the 10 Gauss, 10 to the minus 4 solar masses, 10 to the 5 years. So this phase in here is very short-lived. You would not expect to see too many systems in there. Polarization, pulse shape changes due to the asymmetries you were talking about, would you see any pulses, et cetera, issues that we haven't looked at. And then I just want to finish by saying that, yet again, it's an extreme configuration. It's probably unstable, or it may be unstable. It's an idealized description. But these are the consequences of it. And it has the observational predictions that I described. Those predictions are all directly testable. You don't need anything fancy to test them. Okay.
I'm going to ask two related questions. Superconductors don't like magnetic fields.
Mm-hmm.
When you put magnetic fields in, they have to put them into quantized flux loops, which have 10 to the 15 Gauss. It takes a tremendous amount of energy to organize the field in a superconductor. If it's stuck with the field to start with,
mm-hmm.
then it does it rather than give up superconductivity. But it seems to me that if you're taking a layer with magnetic field and you're very, very slowly moving it down, squeezing it,
mm-hmm.
stuff coming on, it's moving maybe 10 to the minus 7 or 8 centimeters a second. You know, kind of, I don't really know the answer, but the first thought would be that the magnetic field is not going to get into the superconductor. It's going to stay out, like zone refining, you know, impurities
sure.
in the solid state.
Right, yes.
You know, like get them into the crystals.
Mm-hmm.
If that's true, then you're likely to have this magnetic field, at least the outside star, all compressed in the crustal layer.
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't been helped you be superconductive.
Mm-hmm.
Church would be superconductive
mm-hmm.
below that. Then the question of the eddy current diffusion time out becomes very critical. Now, if I understood what I thought Lars was saying, I keep making new crust. I push the existing crust down, and the new crust is it has a lot of burning,
mm-hmm.
and the burning gives me, like, from the electrical point of view, a lots of impurities.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that the eddy diffusion number is very far away from these estimates that you wrote up the last few read. Now, you've got to keep that under there for about 10 of the 10th years, because you have a lot of millisecond pulsars that seem to be 10 of the 10th years old. There's a lot of bunch in there.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I thought that the best estimate was more like a million years.
Yeah, the ohmic diffusion time at the base of the crust is the same as the accretion time at an accretion of 10 to the minus 10 solar masses per year, roughly. So that means that if the crust is 10 to, well, it's on, let's say the crust is 10 to the minus 2 solar masses, then that's 10 to the 8 years is the ohmic time.
Okay, so it's only 100 to that range. But keeping it buried may turn out to be the
difficult,
really crucial problem, but I think it's likely to end up in the crust.
If it stays.
Remember that the field you started with was a one of 10 to the 12 caps.
Yes.
And it's got squeezed, so it's 10 to the 13 caps.
Sure.
You've got to keep that in that crust better than one part in 10 to the 4th can you really count. Because you don't want to be 10 to the 9 caps.
Well, what happens when accretion halts? There's one of your graph you didn't show.
Yes.
What's your vision of what happens once accretion shut off?
Yes. Yep. Okay. So, what happens when accretion stops? Well, the first thing is that the gravitational spin down time, once you've switched off the accretion torque, is super short. Okay? For at least for epsilons of 10 to the minus 6 and p of 3 milliseconds.
Okay.
Doesn't
it have to be equal to the accretional spin up time if you end up balancing accretion?
Well, it was, but if once accretion stops, there is now no accretion.
So you're saying the accretional spin-up time is 10 to the 5 years? That seems awfully short.
No, it's about
10
to
right.
6.
Okay, so that's obviously really short, and then the question is, what happens to them? To the most deformed objects, I should point out that there's strong dependencies here, so you move out of that regime quickly. But to the most deformed objects, one possibility is that they spin down very quickly due to gravitational radiation, though, to the right of the death line, and then you just don't see them. But the big problem with that is that there are obviously plenty of 10 to the 8 Gauss millisecond pulsars that you do see, so why didn't they do that? The second possibility is that the deformation somehow relaxes to be like epsilon of order 10 to the minus 8 or less. And you can see that if you go to 10 to the minus 8, then this is 10 to the 9 years, you don't have that much of a problem. For example, by something like ohmic diffusion. And here is the estimate of the diffusion time. The problem with this then in the burial model would be that you might expect, although of course we don't know, but you might expect that as the deformation, as the mass deformation relaxes, so does the magnetic deformation. And then your magnetic field will pop back up to 10 to the 10 Gauss or whatever and not be 10 to the 8 Gauss. And then you would still have to explain these 10 to the 8 Gauss millisecond pulsars.
Andrew, but if you have gravitational radiation, then all of your estimates of magnetic fields are wrong. Right? Because you estimate magnetic field by looking at the spin down time. So if the spin down is due to gravity wave.
The spin down cannot be due to none of the millisecond pulsars you see with a magnetic field of 10 to the 8 Gauss can be spinning down due to gravity waves and have an epsilon that is this large. Right? Because they just wouldn't live there. I mean, they wouldn't spend any time. You would never see them. They would go straight past the death line and you'd never see them again. Like within 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 years. So anything that you do actually see must be either spinning down by magnetic dipole radiation or spinning down with by gravitational radiation, but for small epsilon. And then, you know, you're not learning. You're right, there's some uncertainty about what the magnetic field is, but it's not easy to disentangle.
No, but if you shut off accretion, mm-hmm. you take your configuration.
Mm-hmm. I would say...
And you just allow ohmic diffusion.
Mm-hmm.
Right, the dipole will come... I mean, this just moves back to the field.
I think so. And I think that'll...
Can the dipole come back?
I think so. That's why I'm saying it's a problem.
Okay. Yeah. I'm just trying to understand.
I think it will. Now, it won't come back totally.
Even the slightest little bit of it coming back.
Yeah, sure.
such a huge field.
Mm-hmm. Now, the diffusion, here is roughly the timescale for the diffusion using very, very crude estimates for the conductivity, like the simple ones. And 10 to the 11 years with this scaling squared. When you move, say you started with 2.2, which was 10 meters in size, or 1 meter, by the time you get to, say, 10 to 100 meters, that ohmic diffusion time has gone down, so that now it's kind of comparable to the age of the system and stuff. So I might imagine that it would relax to a 2.2 of, say, 100 meters in size. But you're totally right, because at 100 meters in size, the dipole field is now 10 to the 10, and therefore much larger than what you actually see. So that it's absolutely...
I'd like to come back to the issue of instabilities. By now, there's a sort of a small industry of people computing barrel in this or related ways.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, people may get the feeling that this is okay to do. But I think there's really a very serious problem here.
Yeah.
And to appreciate that, just let mm-hmm. me start yeah. with creating a little bit onto this polar cap.
Mm-hmm.
Now, initially, if you haven't bent the field very far, maybe that this configuration is still stable.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have dumped a very large amount of mass on it, so it's now horizontal,
mm-hmm.
and you can say calculations on buoyancy instability, you may also find it a bit stable regime. And but the point is that in between something really serious happens.
Mm-hmm.
And if as soon as you sort of deform the magnetic field beyond the specific perturbations of order unity,
yes.
you'll lose your equilibrium. This is the one thing that happens.
Yep.
And I think at the latest at that time, you'll see these instabilities happen. Now we know what they do. I remind you that this is the first way that people thought that we're going to confine plasma
mm-hmm.
for nuclear fusion.
Mm-hmm.
And it has been known for half a century now what happens.
Mm-hmm.
You get violent interchange instabilities, also called ballooning.
Mm-hmm.
And they go on an alpha in time scale. Now, by the time you've deformed your magnetic field with 10 to the minus 12 solar masses, your Alphane travel time is a millisecond.
Mm-hmm.
This is by a large factor the very shortest time scale you have in your whole problem.
Agreed, totally.
Now, in fact, what will happen if you just see what these experiments will tell you is that you get a filamentation, or what you call it, a fragmentation by which the field-free fluid and the field-containing fluid sort of interchange
mm-hmm.
in the radial direction, actually, you see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
On a scale sufficiently small that the ohmic diffusion will then take care of the rest.
Mm-hmm.
And this, since this already sets in when you have accreted only 10 to the minus 12 solar masses, and any other regime that you would like to be in
mm-hmm.
will happen after maybe 10 to the minus 2 solar masses, mm-hmm. there's an enormous range.
Okay.
These instabilities will dominate.
Okay.
If that happens, I think, you know, why don't you take the opposite point of view and score points that way? Because, I mean, it will be such a simple picture. Mass just drifts across the field lines.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were, for example, follow the consequences of that mm-hmm. for whatever observational material you have, I think you'll be doing much more innovative kind of work.
A more realistic problem. I agree with what you say, but there's a couple of things to remember. The first is that if there's complete freedom of material to move across the field line, okay, then magnetic dipole moment doesn't change. Right? Second thing is that interchange instabilities are, of course, going to be totally important. But there's an important question as to how the instabilities evolve. It is true to say that it's going to be unstable, but here you have a slightly unusual situation, which is also the case in solar flares, where your foot points are tied to the plasma. And so the evolution of the instability is going to be, the evolution of the instability is going to be inhibited in some way, because the interchange depends on flipping all the flux tubes around, and you can't flip all the flux tubes around because, well, you can a little bit, but at the bottom you can't because the foot points are tied to the crust. So
it's sufficiently high M that the energy depth just spent in that way goes away. But there is probably a limit. You have to exceed a certain deviation. Mm-hmm. And that's why this is a bit pernicious. In the initial configuration may well be stable. Mm-hmm. You have accreted only a little. And the final configuration, if you dump a lot of it, may also be somewhat stable. But in between is an enormous thing. Mm-hmm. Now, I think it's not entirely fair to say that we don't know what happens when this instability sets in. Because people know what happens. You can see it happening, for example, in these plasma devices.
So let me wrap this up, but I think the line tying is an important subtlety. The other is the buoyancy. The buoyancy issue is very important in these cases. And a lot of these analogs, the plasma devices, you don't have the buoyancy effect or anti-buoyancy, the fact that you're stably stratifying really does modify a lot of the simple arguments.
And can I just...
subtle issue.
But that's a good argument. Once you have buried this whole stuff below a layer of stably stratified material.
But it's all stably stratified from the get-go.
But from the beginning, you don't not get in that situation. You bump these field lines away a little bit. Mm-hmm. And you have mass suspended by magnetic fields.
But you're always stably stratified.
Well,
along the field.
Yeah, but along that interface is always unstable.
Let me just add one more thing, because and then we can finish. But the one, in addition to interchange, you also have obviously the possibility of overturned Parker. Okay. Now, the evolution of overturned Parker is that the lighter the magnetic field lines are going to dip, and all of the make some corrugation, and all of the heavy fluid is going to fall to the bottom of the dips. Okay, and then these bubbles, like these loops of magnetic field, are going to come out. In order for Parker to be unstable, you need that the ratio of gamma here is like the ratio of the refractive indices of the gas, so 5/3 or whatever. That ratio is less than this number here, and this number is the ratio of the Alfvén speed to the sound speed.
Yeah, okay. Now, this is for horizontal fields. I agree. Yeah, now, you can make those stable.
So this is a local criterion for the case that Parker did with the horizontal field. Absolutely. Nevertheless, with this thing, the crucial thing is that this alpha in the hydromagnetic equilibrium is going to be of order unity by definition, and because you've got B squared balancing P. And so this is now something like, you know, 1 is less than 1 or 2 or whatever. And so there is an uncertainty when you apply this local instability criterion, which may not be the correct one, almost certainly not the correct one for global, but the best I could do at the moment is this local one. When you apply the local one, you're not sure whether it's going to be unstable or not. Second important point is that once it does become, suppose that it did become unstable, immediately it relaxes to a state where you have alpha much, much less than 1, like outside this layer where things are going on. And then if you then apply the local criterion, which may not be valid, but if you do apply the local criterion, you'll find that it will stabilize.
I would argue just the opposite. The local, you can do a local analysis and convince yourself that that's okay, in fact. These modes are localized. Or actually, by energy method, you can show that the local analysis is okay. And the opposite, even the second point, the saturates, that is known not to be the case. If you follow an alpha that was Parker's initial mm-hmm. application, the formation of these huge loops in the galactic disk mm-hmm. that you then can use for making molecular clouds and things like this, and that's because the magnetic field, once it's up and it has gotten rid of this stable amount of mass on it, then there's nothing that will stop it from expanding further and further into the vacuum.
But here there is, because here you have the accreted, I agree with you, but here you have the accreted column, which is pushing it, so it relaxes a little bit.
Not as soon as mass can drain along the field lines, then it's essentially a vacuum bubble that pushes through the material.
Well,
okay, I think we should. Okay, let's thank Andrew again.